She doesn't just shape young minds, she empowers them to think differently. She's taken the convention of education and challenged our expectation. She's a maverick who brings out the excellence in everyone around her. My guest on Think Underground today is Arlinda Demiri. Arlinda, welcome underground.
Thank you for having me.
This is Think Underground. Insightful and intelligent conversation with entrepreneurial giants, impact leaders, and titans. Coming up next on Think Underground.
I have been looking forward to this for a long time. I've had the pleasure of knowing you for a little while in some different capacities around community and within industry. And you're always somebody who somehow magically not only challenges me to think and to think critically, but you also leave me walking away both refreshed and reinvigorated, hopeful for tomorrow. So I'm so glad for this opportunity to share a little bit of time with you and to actually share you with the world. So so let's get started. You're a tutor. You operate a tutoring service. And that is certainly something that I think fairly has gotten quite amount of attention over the last years and decades, and certainly no more so than during the recent pandemic that the entire world has had to endure and experience, and parents and guardians having to suddenly become teachers and balance all sorts of elements in their life. And well, let's get right into that, because we've often wondered as a society, is the quality of education in Canada or in North America or around the world keeping up with the needs and the demands of our students, of our youth, and shall we use the term future-proofed or future-ready, our next generation of students? Even before getting into the pandemic, let's talk about the education system and why you felt the need, or why you felt that there was a gap that required your attention and your expertise.
That's a great question. And really, the answer is twofold, in the sense that the gaps that I was noticing when I was still tutoring myself back in the very beginning, there was persistent pieces of the curriculum that were operating for students across multiple domains. And what I felt really was happening was a lack of foundational skill building, or at very least a lack of confidence in that foundational skill building from the students and from parents. And more often than not, students at the upper levels were struggling with concepts that were actually those from previous years. And ultimately, if we're not addressing those foundational skill gaps, it's very difficult to build, because concepts like math and literacy, they snowball upon themselves. And it's ultimately going to be challenging for a student to comprehend grade 11 university level functions, for example, if they have not mastered concepts such as solving algebraic expressions and things of that nature. So that was really the impetus for building the business the way that we did, and in a way that was really focused on concept mastery. And our, one of our guiding principles is ensuring that students not only are seen as a human being with a holistic background and really someone who is multifaceted and not just a learner, but also an individual who lives in a society. And to sort of allude to that first part of your question as to whether or not Canadian and North American learning systems are adequate, I really think that there's a lot that's being done right. And I will say that teachers are quite literally the backbone of this society. They're doing everything in their power. At least the teachers that I know are doing everything in their power to ensure that the students in their care are being taken care of, not just from an academic perspective, but also from a human perspective as well. But I do think as a society, there's a lot more that needs to be done. First and foremost, I mean, we see major disparities in terms of socioeconomic status across Ontario, but also, of course, across Canada and the US as well. And we're not really doing much to mitigate that. And what has been shown in the research time and time again is that one of the key factors that influences academic success is one's socioeconomic standing. And this can also be linked to tutoring because you look at, of course, people from affluent communities are more, are able to access services such as tutoring more readily, right? And then, you know, I could talk about this all day, Arif, so I don't want to bore you too much on that, but really—
No, actually, I want to actually, I'm going to double down on that once you're done, but finish your thought, because trust me, you're not boring me. Roll with it.
So that's one piece. I think that it's really crucial that we address those disparities that exist within our nation, within our province, we'll say, because I don't want to speak for Canada as this ubiquitous, you know, landmass, because that's just not how education operates in the country. It's very germane to the specific region in which you live. But, you know, I do think that what we've seen in North America is this paradigm shift away from really that rote memorization that used to be sort of the cornerstone of the educational system. And the instructional design has moved towards more of a constructivist approach, as we call it, where we're teaching children things like how to break down algorithms instead of ensuring that they have algorithmic automaticity, which, again, I can dive deep into that too. We don't have to go deep into each of these pieces if you don't want to, but really the instructional design piece is where I think there needs to be major overhaul, because what we've seen with the influx of this new, I don't want to call it too new because it's been about 20 years or so, ideology that's happened with the discovery math and all of those pieces moving towards a more balanced literacy approach as opposed to a structured literacy approach, there is a real need for moving back to ensuring fundamentals are in place. Whether it's from a literacy acquisition perspective, whether it's from building math, you know, computational automaticity, there's so many pieces that need to be addressed. And then, you know, I really think that we're leaving a lot of students in the dust when it comes to not just those core subjects that we think of as math and reading, writing as well, but we're not really setting up students for the future that is going to exist. You know, while in Ontario we've added some modicum of financial literacy, it's really not where it should be, in my opinion. We're not really teaching social emotional skills explicitly, which are going to be the crucial skills that really are going to be necessary for success in the gig economy that students are going to be graduating into by that time. And then critical thinking skills, understanding logical fallacies, understanding media literacy, understanding how to construct an argument and actually have discourse that is salient, but also cerebral at the same time. Because I think what's happening, you know, as we see as a society, there's so much disconnect and that cognitive dissonance around what is fact and what is not fact, and how do we argue for our side or for whatever side you're in the place to argue for. So I'm happy to dive into any of those. That's kind of the overview of my perspective on educational reform and what needs to happen in this country for sure.
Well, I certainly appreciate it. I love hearing the perspective and the lens through which you're looking, first and foremost. It would be very easy for anyone to be opening up an enterprise that says, I'm here to fill a gap and I'm going to tell you everything that's wrong with the existing system, which is why I have opened my business. And that's exactly what you haven't done. What you've done is said that we're doing a lot right. There's obviously a lot of opportunity. Now, there are a lot of players and a lot of components in the mix. One can't deny. We're about to talk about education, and we're here to talk about education. And we can't talk about education without talking about who are the parts that make up the sum. And that includes, you know, so much of this is generationally passed along. And as we know, government and those who create legislation are slow to turn or slow to adapt, conventionally speaking. Of course, throw in a pandemic and it's amazing what you can do in 90 days if there's a political will to do so. You might notice I have a bit of a bias in there once in a while that might creep out. And apologize to you and to anybody who's listening to this, but you know, we are two humans having a conversation here. But one of the components and a critical component is political will. And how do you move such a massive, you know, machine or an organization when you've got 4 years to do it? sometimes, right? Because your term, you may be elected and you may be unelected within 4 years, of which you need at least the first year to start figuring things out. You know that when you inherit the last party's books, that there's the facts, and then there was the facts that were presented. And so that first year, oftentimes in politics, the different persons in charge of the different ministries are actually figuring out, you know, what did I actually inherit as a portfolio? And so then you don't have 4 years, and then you've got 3 years maybe to do something. So without going too far into politics itself, politics in our society plays a strong role in education and in the development or the trajectory of education as it may suit the mandate of that elected government. So that's one component that I'm looking at. And then you're looking, obviously, there's school boards and those who are tasked with disseminating the information. And then there are the educators who are tasked with disseminating further the education objectives. And then there's also the component of the family that supports the learner or the student and their ability to be equipped to ensure that their student is ready to receive that information. There's so many components. I'm not here to teach you. I'm not here to teach you anything. I'm saying my perspective, I'm breaking it down at how complex something so simple as just teach people what they need to know so that they can thrive in their life, how complex that actual formula is.
You know, Arif, I think about this a lot more than I wish I did, quite frankly. The first thing I'll say is really that it's unfortunate that education and healthcare and so many other domains are politicized in the way that they are, because it really detracts from the level of growth that could happen within those, I'll say, industries, although they're not industries in the traditional sense. Because when the focus is more on the electorate's response to your policy change and how that's going to play as a soundbite, then it is what's actually best and what is the evidence-based approach and how can we maximize the opportunity that we have and the finances that we have in place, it's going to be detrimental not only to children, but also to the people who care for children. And really to society, because ultimately, who are those children going to become? They are the adults of tomorrow. They're the ones who are going to need to lead society. And if we're not really putting our full support behind what is right for them, and when I say what is right, I don't mean in an arbitrary sense. I mean, really, what does the evidence show as being the best approach? I'll give an example. So the Ontario Ministry of Education a while back was brought to the Human Rights Commission for their reading program. And, you know, it had been quite evident over the last 15, 20 years that the balanced literacy approach that was in place, where, sort of to give some background, where they were having students use a whole word approach. So having students guess words, having students learn large chunks of words instead of doing the structured literacy approach, which is the gold standard, the evidence-based approach that has proven to work for students both with exceptionalities as well as students who don't have exceptionalities. So, you know, when we look at that, it took someone taking them to court might be a strong word, but taking them to the Human Rights Commission and really pushing this issue in order for this change to be made, right? And we see that education is politicized in lots of democracies. I mean, you look at the US, that's every day is a new headline about what they're banning from schools and what they're not banning from schools, et cetera. But if we remove ourselves from that political sphere and look at education or look at healthcare as just a system or an organization that needs to run efficiently, I think it would have a much different approach. But to your point, where you only have 4 years to do so, I think that's part of the issue, that we're trying to rewrite the equation every 4 years when there are components of the equation that are working. It doesn't need to be rewritten just so that your party can say, well, we did this and this party over here, they didn't do that, or whatever the case may be, because that's actually removing the real core need that's happening here, which is that children need to be educated. And it's a public service that needs to be provided to everybody in a way that is equitable. So back to my point about mitigating those socioeconomic effects, that's also political, right? Because that will require governments to make changes in terms of how they distribute resources to people who are in need of those resources.
Arlinda, there is so much information in here and I'm loving it. And we're not going anywhere anytime soon because there is so much to continue on this topic. We're talking about education. We're talking about changes in education, generational or technological advances that are prompting and prodding us to see change. But you brought up the conversation or the point around disparity and disparity amongst different socioeconomic groups in society. And, you know, education is one of those pillar items. You mentioned healthcare, you mentioned education. There, I'm sure, are a number of other of those similar pillars within our democratic society, democracy. And when it comes to education, the ideal was that it was equal access to everybody wherever you are. And your argument is that there's nothing, I'm going to put words in your mouth a little bit, nothing farther from the truth, in the sense that the different areas are resourced differently. And tell us more about why you see there is a disparity. And then talk to me about really tutoring and where you're coming from in terms of providing service as being a tool that is available access to those who can provide that for their students and for their children.
Yeah, so what I see in terms of disparity is more so on an individualistic level here in Ontario, because I will say that actually Ontario, in terms of the differences between school boards, they're relatively similar in the sense that they are given similar resources. You know, there's not one school board that is extravagantly wealthy, you know, unlike in the US where a particular board or a particular school is largely influenced by just property taxes in the region, which obviously can create extreme disparities in, you know, resources and pieces like that. What I see here more in Ontario, from my perspective, is that those individual disparities and individual needs are not being addressed. So, for example, if we look at, you know, education similarly to how we look at health, in that we look at those determinants of health, I think there is something similar in education. We have seen that the socioeconomic status of a student does have a correlation with how they progress throughout the trajectory of their educational career. And one of those pieces is that oftentimes students who require help, who are from more well-off families, are able to receive tutoring. I will give the Ontario government some credit where credit was due. They did implement a very broad tutoring program this year to help mitigate the effects of COVID, which were immense and which are still, you know, permeating throughout the educational system. But if we don't address things like hunger, poverty, all of those pieces, ensuring that there's stable housing for everybody, that's going to cause quite a bit of friction for the students in the schools. And beyond that, I also think that a trauma-based approach is incredibly important, because we have students who live through just the worst of tragedies or are living in situations at home that are not safe or not ideal. And the goal is that those children will be, you know, the needs of those children will be addressed. But in many cases, school is a safe place for those kids. And that was part of the issue with COVID, was that we took away that safe space for a lot of students, which ultimately had long-term effects in terms of literacy, mathematics, et cetera. But beyond that, it also had long-term effects in terms of their self-regulation. And what it really comes down to is that we need to be creating the inputs and the environment in which learning can take place. So, and if we don't address...
Sorry, Linda, let's talk about that just for a second, if you will, because one person's perspective might be that, fantastic, the school boards, you know, if there was a family that didn't have a laptop, they might send a laptop home during the pandemic that had a camera and the ability to connect to the internet. Even internet connectivity actually became an issue. So while the government and the school boards were forced to roll programs out virtually or online, there were those in communities who didn't have this bandwidth required to get that streaming, etc. So one might say, hey, fantastic, we're making education available to anyone everywhere. And what you're pointing out, and I think quite rightly, and enough studies will show this, that the learning environment has to be right for a student. And so that school was a safe place. And, you know, it is a sensitive topic, obviously, and as it should be, and it's one that deserves attention, but there are a number of households or homes that aren't properly equipped or suitable for peaceful, safe learning environment. And what are the environmental inputs in that environment where the student is being required to learn?
Yeah, that's a great question. Really, what I think is so crucial to look at is addressing individual needs, right? Because you can make a statement about the environment of a classroom that perhaps doesn't apply to a certain cohort of students within that classroom. And when we talk about using an equity-based approach, what we're really saying is look at each individual student and allow them that sovereignty, that ability to be part of a system, but also be an individual. So one piece that I think is really important to address is exceptionalities. So one thing that we're seeing is a huge point of friction across so many school boards here in Ontario is really providing the resources and support for students with exceptionalities. That's one key piece. You know, to your point about the at-home learning, part of the issue there, which is part of the issue that we see in terms of the socioeconomic status and its correlation, is that some kids, not by any fault of their own, nor by any fault of their parents, have parents that have multiple jobs who really, really depend on the school environment being a place where their children can be safe for 8 hours a day, right? And so when you took that away, you also took away a lot of people's earning abilities because somebody needed to stay home depending on the age of the children. And in doing so, you also took away that support system that exists within the schools. But what we saw recently in Ontario with the education workers strike is that there is sort of that peripheral support system that is really endemic to the school system that's required for a school system to operate efficiently. And we see time and time again that those supports are not in place. You have teachers trying to teach in a classroom with 30 children, which in and of itself is not ideal. That's far too many children for one classroom. But beyond that point, you also have so many children in a classroom that individual student needs, such as a student who might have an individualized education plan for, let's say, a language learning exceptionality, is not being addressed. Not because the teacher doesn't want to or isn't trying, but because there just is not enough time in a day without that support person or an EA in the classroom who could be a facilitator in that regard. So, I mean, I think I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, because there are some school boards who are really putting in all of the efforts that are necessary, but I would argue that it's not for every single child and not everything is looked at the same way. Now, an example of this is that, for example, recently we were consulting with a family whose child is exceptionally gifted, which giftedness is considered an exceptionality. It's considered something that needs to be addressed. And so this child, they are currently in a grade that is not appropriate for their developmental level. And there was lots of proof, there was support from the principal, there was support from so many different facets of this child's life, arguing that this child needs to be moved up a grade. And mind you, this child is working with us doing work three grades above their grade level with no problem, right? Because they're understimulated in the school system. And they genuinely don't enjoy going to school because of course it is boring for them. And that lack of support that we saw is something that is very common. And that happens not just with students with exceptionalities such as giftedness, but also other exceptionalities, which realistically is an equity issue and is a human rights issue. Because if you are not addressing someone's needs, especially if they have a disability, right, which, giftedness is not considered a disability, but there are cases where the exceptionality is also a disability. And if you're not addressing that because you don't have the funding, then there needs to be another discussion back on the political level about what level of funding is appropriate. So if we look at schools as a system in which there needs to be particular outcomes, learning objectives, not just from a standardized testing perspective, but also from the perspective of stakeholder engagement, what we're really seeing is that there is a lack of trust in the system, especially from parents who have to consistently advocate for their children to get the required pieces that are going to be beneficial for them. So there's so many different ways you can approach this discussion, but I do think that if we look at it from the individual level first and foremost, then we can sort of see what are those systemic issues that also need to be addressed in step with that concomitantly.
So a simple question would be, if you look back at the last 20 years of your life, how many significant changes or advancements has society sort of adopted and learned to become agile and pivot and all these words that have been thrown out there, innovate, evolve, right? What has changed? If you look back 20 years, what are you still doing today that you were doing back then? And I'm not talking about dress yourself in the morning and put food in your mouth, but from a day-to-day basis of how you interact with people, how you carry yourself in business, how society operates and works in general, how many changes can you say has society sort of witnessed, endured, and adapted to in that period of time? And then please give me an idea of how the education system that we know in Western culture, Western society, has aligned with those changes.
So society itself, as I think we can all attest, has changed consistently, rapidly. I mean, that delta is always happening, right? At the end of the day, I would argue that technology and the rise of, you know, Web 2 and then Web 3 has really been the key piece that has altered the course of humanity. And at the end of the day, if we look at what's happening in the private sector, there is so much that really attests to human resilience. And of course, in the public sector, there's so much about human resilience as well. But I think humanity's ability to adapt and create more value. And I think what's happened in the educational world is not that there aren't amazing people trying to do incredible work, but back again to this issue that education and healthcare are so intrinsically linked with the political system and with the electoral system that it ultimately creates sort of a never-ending cycle that keeps us behind. Because you have educators who are really trying to implement all of those pieces and looking at things from an evidence-based approach. But without the approval of the ministry, without the approval of school boards, then they're going against their mandate. And that can ultimately create jeopardy for them and their jobs. So we have to recognize that as a society, if we are not investing in really future-proofing the world, or future-proofing our children, we are creating a potential issue for us 20 years from now, right? Because if we know the way, or if we have a general sense of the way that society is going to have its trajectory or move towards a certain domain or realm, and we're not preparing our children adequately for that, then we have failed them, right? So what we see time and time again in the educational domain is that there are these great ideas. There's neuroscience and, you know, educational research being done every day, but it's not necessarily the actual legislative changes that are taking place are not in alignment with that. That's not true of every single country. I mean, if we look at Finland, they were very close to the bottom of the world rankings for education. And when they saw this, they said, okay, well, let's actually talk to neuroscientists, let's talk to educators, people who are in educational research, and create a curriculum and sort of a paradigm shift that is going to be beneficial for us as a country and for our youth. And now they are quite near the top, if not at the very top, of the world educational rankings. And if we look at the Finnish system, we see that they don't start school until 7 years old, when children are developmentally at an age typically that enables them to acquire the content that is necessary. They also, for those first number of years of learning, have a very play-based curriculum. It doesn't mean that they're not learning content, but there is not this emphasis on, you know, the more structured, standardized approach that we see here in North America. And if you want to really dig deep and look into what's going on in North America, particularly in the US, although to some degree here in Canada as well, there is a level of monopolization in the education industry. You know, you have one or two publishers who create the standardized testing, and they also create the remediation materials for those issues with standardized testing that take place. So to some degree, there is a conflict of interest there, right? But if we let corporate interests control what's going on, and if we let the electorate or the perception of what is right control what's happening in education, then we're losing sight of what actually works. And there is tons of evidence for what actually works. We just need to be willing to implement it and put the money where our mouth is, basically.
Let me step back just for a moment. And I don't know that I've ever asked this question. And again, pretty fundamental or basic level question. But what is the purpose of an educational journey, the conventional educational K to 12 journey? Let's leave aside post-secondary just for a moment. What is the purpose of it?
Well, I think there's the aspirational purpose and then the actual purpose and sort of the galvanizing force behind what started education. So as one of your previous guests mentioned, and she was really right on the money, is when the Industrial Revolution happened is when we started seeing public education become more of a service that was available to everybody, right? And what was the key piece that really led that was that they needed workers and they needed an educated workforce, at least to some degree, so that they could have people working in factories, they could have people who were compliant and had an ability to withstand an 8-hour work day, similar to the 8-hour school day, able to listen to those in charge, etc. Right? Now, when we look at the aspirational goal of education, I think what any educator would tell you is that we are really trying to not only build the necessary underpinnings for a successful life, meaning really having all of those pieces such as core mathematical skills, literacy skills, and understanding of the society around us and what brought us here from a historical perspective as well. Beyond that, though, what we really, in my mind, should be aspiring to is to create a cohort of individuals who are going to be able to maximize their personal skill sets, those things that they have natural proclivities for, and create a society in which there is equity and there also is opportunities for success as well for themselves and for other people. But I do think that that's the piece where we are lagging in some respects because we have not provided students with all of those key pieces. I mean, we look at soft skills like negotiation, really just building consensus, understanding how to have empathy for one another. Those pieces are incredibly important. And I think anyone who's worked in the corporate world knows that oftentimes it's those individuals who have those strong executive function skills, as well as those strong communication skills, tend to be those who succeed the most. And I mean, when I say success, I mean kind of from an empirical standpoint, right? What the issue here is, though, is that we're also not providing students with the tools and resources that can help them become resilient human beings. Because as we all know, nobody leaves this life unscathed. Everybody has something that happens to them or that has taken place throughout the time that they're alive that isn't easy. But what we've done is focus so much just on the academic portion that I think we've forgotten that students are humans. And back to that initial notion of creating an equitable society, when we see that students from families who have that support system in place do tend to thrive, why are we not providing a similar support system, an ecosystem for success within our educational domain and system?
So I think this is a perfect segue to ask you this question. There are a number of nationally recognized tutoring organizations out there. What is Scholarly Elite doing differently?
There are quite a few things that we do differently than traditional tutoring. First and foremost, what we really do is have a very comprehensive assessment process so that we can ascertain exactly what are those areas of friction that each student has, and also test on those areas of friction. Because of course, we can't just say, all right, well, we're going to, you know, have this discussion with the student and a parent and then not also have the evidence to back that up. So we have those discussions. We create very in-depth personal learning plans that are targeting foundational skill building as it pertains to the goals and the learning objectives for that student. And then we put in the inputs that are necessary to create and to build an environment that is conducive to success. So that includes pieces such as speaking with parents, speaking with teachers as well, which is something that is unheard of, I think, in the tutoring industry. So we literally, with parents' permission, will reach out to a student's teacher and say, what are the key areas that you think this student needs to focus on? Is it their expressive skills? Their, you know, what are the areas that are going to be most beneficial for them as they pertain to the specific subject, which is where they're receiving tutoring? Beyond that, we also then create those fully enriched personal learning plans, which are going to target only those areas first and foremost that really are necessary. Because, you know, for example, we sometimes get parents asking us something along the lines of, well, my student didn't do well in grade 9 math. Should I just have them redo grade 9 math? And the answer is typically no. Of course, we look at the individual situation, of course, take that into account as well. But it's not so much about looking at just what needs to get done, but also what is going to be the most impactful use of that student's time. So we then create personal learning plans that actually are workbooks. One copy is given to the tutor, one copy is given to the student, so that the student has a chance for that retrieval practice on their own outside of tutoring, for the ability to have that spaced repetition that is so necessary, that we know, you know, from evidence has proven to be incredibly beneficial for students. And in doing so, we are building the foundations for concept mastery. And I think that's what's missing a lot of times from the educational perspective, is that what we see in the educational system, not by any one person's fault, but because of the way that we have allowed the system to become, is that we essentially have children practice one skill set for 1 week or 2 weeks and then test them on it. And then they don't talk about that skill set again for an extended period of time, causing gaps. And in doing so, we are actually working against the neuroscience and the evidence that has shown us how spaced repetition, consistent practice are very helpful. I mean, Usain Bolt does not practice for his Olympic run the day before. He's doing so consistently throughout his time as an athlete, building towards something. And similarly, when we're trying to build the neural scaffolding that is necessary for concrete learning, what it really comes down to is having that repetition, having that assurance that a student feels confident in a particular subject and that they're being exposed to that subject frequently enough that it's not, there's no digression, there's no reduction in their skill as they move forward in time, or continue on in their education, because there's discussions about whether time is linear, and we're not going to get into that. But back to your initial question, what we do differently at Scholarly Elite is that we see the student as an individual who deserves respect on a holistic scale. So we're looking at them not only just as learners, but also as human beings, and taking into account their interests, their likes, the way that they learn, and as well as any sort of exceptionalities or IEPs. So we read a lot of IEPs, which is something that's not done traditionally in tutoring, so that we can incorporate them into our practice as well. And building them towards that level of confidence and self-efficacy that is necessary, because it's not just about fixing tomorrow's math test. It's about ensuring that they're a lifelong learner of math and someone who feels capable of completing math at higher levels, because most people are. And unfortunately, the system we have in place often deters people because we're so concerned about today's mark instead of understanding that it's about building that core skill set that's going to help carry them throughout the rest of their education.
So it's really interesting what I'm hearing, because in some other areas of work, we have a very similar philosophy, and that is the importance of what we are offering is not to try to fit our program into the client, but to build a program for for the client. And so, you know, I'm hearing some of the more conventional methodologies that might be more of an off-the-shelf approach that says, this is how you learn math, this is how we teach English, and then take the student and try to subject them to it, so to speak. And I'm hearing that the exact opposite is the approach that's being used. You talked, you've used the term numerous times today about evidence-based approach. And what I'm hearing is evidence-based approach to help formulate and nurture the critical thinking ability so that the subject matter isn't foreign each time where you're subjecting the individual to the subject matter, but you're actually ingraining the concepts so that it's more of a natural engagement as how they evolve their thought process to sort of see and understand the why, not just the what, but the why and the how. Maybe you can help me out a little bit here because I think I'm close. I'm not sure I'm there.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So the fundamentals are still there. The difference is that we're not putting every student through a standard curriculum in the sense that the fundamentals that we're learning are going to be present regardless. But for example, if your child has already mastered the addition and subtraction of fractions, we will still check on that and ensure that they're there. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's part of their remediation, right? So we need to address those core aspects of their mathematical or literacy acquisition learning that need to be addressed. So what you see in a lot of tutoring spaces is that there is a standard program and kids will sit on an iPad and they're just playing the little game at a group of four. Everything we do is one-on-one. So it's not just practice, although there are built-in pieces such as the workbooks for working on after to consolidate the information, but there's real instruction taking place, direct instruction taking place, which is crucial, especially for students who do require a degree of remediation or in cases where there may be a need for enrichment. So that's really important as well. But really the fundamentals of what needs to be achieved are present because regardless of where your child is in their reading journey, the major objective is reading automaticity and reading fluency, right? So that's what we're trying to aim towards is ensuring that the environment is in place so that each student can achieve success, ensuring that they have those core foundations in place, but in doing so, really looking at who they are as an individual and how we can optimize their learning experience. So our goal is not to keep children in tutoring for all of time. It's typically so that we can get the students to a place where they have a level of self-efficacy, they've built that self-esteem, and they feel confident and are capable of achieving their goals, which is really important as well because there needs to be buy-in from the student. There needs to be, they are really one of the most important stakeholders in this process. And a lot of times we think of the adults in the situation as kind of the driving forces, but without that opting in from the child themselves or from the student themselves, it's going to be very difficult to ensure that that learning is taking place. So looking at sort of those larger social factors, the stress levels that a student may have, and sometimes ensuring that we are the correct approach for them. So in some instances, for example, we might see a student who has a reading issue, but really has a need for a functional vision assessment, which is different from the standard vision assessment. So we will tell parents, before you have your child start tutoring, let's take a look at their functional vision needs first, address those, and then come to tutoring for the remediation piece. Because sometimes it's not an exceptionality that might be, instigating that friction for each child. So hopefully that answers your question a little bit more.
It does, but where I want to go next with this is you've been talking about the individuality, which ultimately, strip it down, it makes the most sense. We are individuals, and I think if we were to summarize the last however many 50, 100 years of the education system, it would be working with the resources we have to provide the best amount of information that we can in the best way that we can to the most people that we can reach. And I appreciate that. But over the last couple of decades, access to information has changed. the way we receive our information, the way we can individually access and explore topics and subject matter has changed. I can do it on my phone. I can go to the library, or the library can come to me. Now, when I look at that, there's a school of thought that I want to sort of put forth to you and get your opinion on it. And that is that it used to be a generally accepted ambition, if you will, to try to get into an Ivy League school, maybe for the prestige, or maybe for the under the belief that that is where there would be access to a superior quality or level of education. Maybe more the former than the latter, but it depends on who the stakeholder is. Okay.
Yeah.
There's an argument now that says that said Ivy League school has the exact same access to the exact same amount of information to the, I don't even know what you'd call it, terabytes worth of education or information that's out there readily available in the world on all the different four corners of our round world, right? So whether you're in an Ivy League school or you're at a community level college or you're at doing self-study just on your own, we all have very similar, in the grand scale of things, access to the same amount of information.
I think Ivy League schools and schools that stake themselves on their reputation are going to have an increasingly difficult time demonstrating their value and demonstrating their value propositions, which really come down to branding, right? I think that's what the Ivies have done incredibly well, is that they've convinced us all that they are some upper echelon of the educational system that supersedes everything else below them, below in quotation marks. And what I really see as being the driving force behind people's desire to attend Ivies is consistently the access that is afforded to them thereafter.
The network.
So the networking, just the fact that they've attended that particular college or university allows them to even apply to certain places that would not have been accepting of them otherwise. So this is particularly true of, you know, medical schools and law schools as well, because we know that that's a very insular system in which there's a lot of interdependence amongst the various organizations in those places. I do think that there is merit and value behind the universities as research institutions. And I do think that there is a level of value that is obtained from attending school with other like-minded individuals as well. I think there's something to be said of that. But you're absolutely correct that there absolutely is information available to everybody. I mean, if we look at what some of these really incredible organizations like Coursera or Khan Academy are doing, they're democratizing education and making it accessible to everybody. And if you hear people like Elon Musk, which I don't love quoting Elon Musk, but I will, you know, to paraphrase him, he talks about how he cares a lot more about skills and the particular skill sets that a person has acquired on their own prior to coming to an organization, which much of which is becoming very modular through the internet, because you can obtain certifications for really many skill sets that are going to be very important over the next 20 years. And more often than not, maybe not more often than not, but in many instances, you're seeing university graduates from some of the best schools on earth still have to go in and increase their knowledge base because they weren't taught particular skills. University is very much, in most instances, a very theoretical place where you're not so much working on hands-on. So even a marketing major may have never actually run a real Google Ads campaign or run a real campaign other than from a theoretical perspective in an essay or argumentative paper. And what these schools really are going to have to prove is whether or not it's worth someone spending the amount of money that it costs to attend these schools in order to succeed based on their own standards of success. In some instances, I think that that is going to be the case continuously. I mean, I don't know that I would want to see a surgeon that wasn't trained at an institution who hadn't gone through the very rigorous process of being selected in the way that schools select individuals. But there are numerous other paths that don't require a university level education. This is also something we consult on with parents quite often, because when you have a student who perhaps isn't certain about what they want to do, do you as a parent really want to be spending upwards of $20,000 to $30,000 a year sending them to school if it's really something that you're pushing and they're not interested in? So I think that there is a level of a reality check that's going to take place. There is going to be some sort of zeitgeist shift around education. Whether it's going to happen as quickly as we would all love it to, I think, perhaps not, just because there are a lot of dollars behind these institutions. There's a lot of, they're deeply embedded into our societal fabric.
Let me ask you this question then on that thought. Do you see that wholesale change happening at an elementary and or even secondary level, or only in a post-secondary level? And the reason I want to sort of give you a little guideline around the question where I'm coming from is you just mentioned, for example, you wouldn't want to have a surgeon who was performing or operating if they hadn't continued to upgrade their skill sets. But when we look conventionally at the education system, and I mean no disrespect to any of our educators, but they may well have gone from K to 12 to post-secondary back into K as an educator. And I don't know, and I'm not familiar with how much continuing ed and recertification happens in the existing conventional system. So as society, going back a little while into some of our questions and our topic points, talking points, as society continues to evolve and as the needs and those skill sets that you referenced from Mr. Musk become more valuable and more in demand, those who are providing the education for the students to meet those tests, are they getting the continuing education so that they can teach that next generation of students that skill set that's going to be required?
So I'll speak to the system here in Ontario, just because that's what I'm most familiar with and really where my research has been primarily. But what we see happening in Ontario, they recently switched the Ontario Teachers College program, the Bachelor of Ed, to be a two-year program that's post-baccalaureate. So you have to have your bachelor's first in order to obtain this two-year degree is on top of that. And at the at the elementary level, what's happening is that there is not specialization taking place in Ontario, meaning very, very rarely will you see a school have just one, like a person who is dedicated to teaching math or dedicated to teaching English. And what I think happens is that this causes a dispersion of skill sets where there is a decrease in certain efficacy as it pertains to teaching certain skills. They're not allowing individuals who really could be the masters of their domains to teach that particular skill set. Now, at the high school level, we do see that we have individualized math teachers, English teachers, etc. And I would argue that the efficiency of that is much better. Now, as to whether or not there will be massive changes taking place, I would hope so. But unfortunately, with a new, once the electoral system gets its way and there's a new, potentially a new head honcho in town, or maybe not, whatever ends up happening, those changes on a governmental level and at scale tend to happen quite laboriously, quite slowly. There's a lot of red tape involved. And it's unfortunate because, you know, back to that discussion around teaching mathematics, right? When we see who is teaching mathematics, I've actually had teachers tell me that there are times when they teach themselves the math the day before they teach it to the students. And that's problematic. Not that it can't be learned, but to me, I think it is much more effective to have someone who is dedicated to teaching math, whose specialty it is to teach math. But unfortunately, part of the issue is also access and also the number of people available, right? This is an issue we see with French. There's not nearly enough French teachers in Ontario. And as a result, you have some schools who don't have as strong of access to French learning. Sure. So as to whether or not changes will take place, I think that's going to be for us as an electoral body, or not an electoral, as an electorate to decide. I think we need to be much more organized and dedicated to the specific issues. I'm incredibly excited to see the changes in the literacy curriculum. I have lots of opinions about what needs to change in the math curriculum, but that's a whole other discussion. As to how the training takes place for educators, I think, again, we should look at the Finnish model and really see how that has benefited them. Those educators at the Finnish level all have a master's of education, which isn't to say that the bachelor's of education isn't efficient in some ways. It's very good at teaching people how to lesson plan and have a more broad approach to teaching, but there is quite a bit lacking. And part of that is, again, not to sound like a broken record, but that evidence-based approach to teaching mathematics, to teaching literacy acquisition, and to teaching those skills on a long-term trajectory, which is ultimately the goal.
I think you'll agree certainly speaking of Ontario, since that's your area of expertise or understanding, the ministry level has made significant changes in implementing a math curriculum overhaul. I know it's sort of a progressive year by year. You know, they finish the 9s and then the 10s and the 11s, et cetera. And then the most recent announcement was that there's going to be a change to the curriculum in terms of adding mandatory credits towards the skilled trades fields, the red seal trades or the skills trades fields. Reason I'm bringing that up is we talk about making sure that we're future-proofing our students and our learners so that there is something for them to do, how to contribute in society and how to survive in society once they graduate. And we are seeing much more demand on the skilled trades, certainly post-pandemic. Also what we learned about our dependency on China, for example, for production, and how we will never have that happen again because it was so costly, mentally, emotionally, financially, economically costly, that there may be a sort of a made in Canada type of approach or a made in North America approach brewing on the horizon to be less dependent internationally. So thoughts on that as a sort of midterm or near to midterm evolution?
I actually think that the skilled trades are going to become increasingly important to us as a society, to your point. I recently saw an opinion piece from someone who was stating that they believe that the skilled trades are actually going to become the white collar jobs of the future, because the AI revolution that's taking place right now is going to make a lot of tech jobs obsolete. And so there is this argument that tech jobs are essentially going to become much more commonplace, and that those who have the skills from a skilled trade are actually going to become the individuals who are most sought out in society, because they're much harder to automate. They're much more individualized. They're jobs that can't always, as of right now, use a computer to be completed. And so I think that the emphasis on skilled trades is very good. That's something that I do commend this current government for. They've made quite a few strides in that regard. That's not to say that there should not be other ways that we're future-proofing the general society that we're creating, which is really the future of these children's educational careers. So, to our discussion earlier, there's a number of pieces that need to be addressed. First of all, we look at financial literacy. The financial literacy that was added to the mathematics curriculum, there was a mathematics curriculum update in 2020 for Ontario. First and foremost, just to give you an overview of my whole spiel on it, I do think that they've added quite a few pieces that are very good. There does need to be a more strong emphasis, a stronger emphasis on rote memorization and computational automaticity, but there also is an overload of content in the current math curriculum. The issue around that is that students are not focusing on those number skills and algebra skills as strongly as they could be, because there's all this other content. You have the data strand, spatial sense strand, financial literacy strand. And I would argue that financial literacy needs to be its own course. In the same way that we teach history separately, you could also incorporate history into math. You could do subtraction of numbers and this and that, but that doesn't mean that you're actually teaching financial principles. And much of what's being included in the financial literacy portion of the curriculum is very disparate in the sense that, you know, it starts here, it doesn't really have a progression that makes sense. And so I think that that's one piece. Now, again, to our point earlier about teaching students things such as having the ability to create an argument, understanding logical fallacies, understanding how to recognize what's being told to them as whether, you know, in terms of whether it's true or not, or objectively appropriate in terms of the discussion that they're having. Those are all pieces that I think are really crucial in terms of future proofing. And other aspects such as public speaking, there still will be jobs that require human to human contact. I think that's something that has become overshadowed by a lot of this technological advancement that's taken place. And a lot of people think tech is the only way. But if we look at what are really going to be the most future-proof jobs, are those in which a person can advocate for themselves and be resilient in an economy where they might need to do multiple jobs at once or be an independent contractor as opposed to an employee, which is increasingly what we're seeing as the paradigm shift in employment. But beyond that, also understanding how to navigate other human beings, how to be emotionally intelligent. What are those core skills beyond just having a standard conversation, which I would argue is something that some of the students that we see now do struggle with more than what people did 20, 30 years ago, because 20, 30 years ago, community was very different. Community, you know, you may have been mixing with adults and children in social spaces much more frequently than we do now, just by way of the fact that, you know, most of the time after school, kids are in extracurricular activities, and then they go home to do homework, and then they go home to sleep. Right? So they're not being exposed to as many human beings, to that opportunity to interact with others. And I think if we don't give them that and explicitly teach them pieces such as how to have a conversation, a lot of kids are not having that opportunity at home. So again, back to that equity piece and ensuring that everybody has equal access to understanding emotional regulation, emotional intelligence, as well as other soft skills that are going to elevate them in their careers and in lifelong success, because it's not about just career. It's about whether or not a person is a well-functioning member of society in the sense that they are content with what it is that they're doing.
I think there's a fairly strong argument and recognition around the fact that there's become a growing dependency and maybe an addiction to also the electronic device, the personal electronic device, which has really, caused people to stop talking to each other. They may be interacting with each other, with their friends on chat, but it has eaten into the market share, if you will, of actual face-to-face dialogue and conversation.
And that's really the key piece, right, is ensuring that students are able to have conversations with people of various generations. What we see time and time again is that students at particular ages are very efficient at the way that they communicate, right? I wouldn't deign to try to understand some meme culture that goes on at the grade 5 level. And they're very good at communicating with one another in that space, but that's not how the corporate world operates. In the corporate world, you likely will be having a boss who may be 30 to 40 years older than you. And that's just part of growing up in society, right? You get to learn from mentors who perhaps are not of the same cohort as you. But in doing so, you need to be able to have really strong conversations with them, or at very least be able to understand how to listen and how to communicate as an individual within a larger context, a social context. So I think that that's a piece that needs to be addressed as well.
Arlinda, I love where this is going, and I really actually see it coming full circle for me here. Let me put something in a little bit of perspective on how I'm ingesting and receiving this information. And I see it as scholarly elite really has found the gap that needed to be served, the value proposition, the place in society as a valued supplement to an existing education system. And the reason why I say that is, first and foremost, obviously it's privatized, but secondly, you found a way to integrate and to communicate and to not create an us versus them, but an and relationship with existing educators and as a conduit and an ambassador for and a liaison with, and you can pick any adjective or adverb as you want, with the existing system there. I'll ask you the question though. I think it's a fair statement, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, that certainly over the last few years, we've seen more and more of a growing movement of parents who were, and maybe it was specifically tied to the pandemic and the realizations or the realities around the fact that parents aren't necessarily teachers and nor should they be, but a dependency to say, listen, my child needs more support than what they're currently receiving within the education system. And therefore, if it's meant to be, it's up to me. And I'm going to go to a private system for supplement. I'm going to go to a tutor and I'm going to take it upon myself. Do you actually see the public education system staying as is as an entity, or do you see a growing movement towards private access? Of course, for those who can afford it, private access to education, whether it's through a full day school system or through a tutoring program such as Scholarly Elite.
So one thing that has been inherent in the educational system, is especially in North America, is that it is to some degree a two-tier system. There always are institutions that the affluent can reach out to ensure that their children are receiving the type of education that they would hope they are receiving. Do I foresee there being a major overhaul in education? Perhaps not all at once, although I would hope that legislators are taking to heart the feedback that they're hearing from parents, because really what's happening in a lot of districts is that students are being left behind because there is not enough funding. There is not enough allocation of resources for students with exceptionalities in particular has been underwhelming to some degree. So that's one piece that I think really needs to be addressed. Whether it is going to be addressed, I think, is largely based on how vocal and how organized we as a population are going to become, because the squeaky wheel, what's the saying? The squeaky wheel gets the grease. Thank you. And what we see, and we saw this with the Human Rights Commission as it pertains to the reading curriculum, was that made a change, but someone had to put in their time and resources in order to fight for that, right? I would argue that historically, there has been a very slow progression in the educational world, largely because it is a government-based entity to some degree. But do I think that there will ever be, at least within the next 20 years, a society in which those who can afford to obtain more resources and more just an education that is more beneficial for their child based on their child's needs, I don't think that's going away anytime soon. And part of that is, again, back to that system in which changes take place and then a new government comes into place and wants to do things their way to prove a point about how they're the best government and et cetera. Ultimately, what that does is keeps us in this two steps forward, one step back. And while we are making progress to some degree, is it the level of progress that could have been made if we were focusing exclusively on what is best practice? And my argument is that from what we've seen historically, that doesn't necessarily take place overnight. And if it is going to change, it's probably going to be quite a period of time before we see real equity in education.
If you could do one thing to change the world,
I would increase educational access for all. And by that, I mean ensure that individual needs are being addressed in a way that is conducive to that person's goals and that person's overall academic trajectory, as well as lifelong trajectory of their personhood as well.
Arlinda Demery, scholarly elite. Every time I speak with you, every time I have the privilege to speak with you, you stretch me, you test me, you throw at least a half dozen words in the vocabulary that I'd never heard of before that I'll have to look up afterwards. But I'm always left feeling grateful for the opportunity to know you. And I know that you have an incredible impact on the people who are in your center of influence. So I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you, for you giving me of your time, and for the ability to share this with anybody who might be fortunate enough to come across are putting this out there for the world to listen to through the podcast channels and other streams. So Arlinda, thank you for the time on Think Underground. You gave me exactly what I was hoping for, which was a challenge, which was an opportunity to think differently, an opportunity to maybe have some new perspective, to grow, and really to get down to the fundamentals of what life is really all about. And you managed to do all of that beautifully. So thank you very much. And I can't wait to the next opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you, Arif. And thank you for having me today, as well as for sharing those kind words. I do appreciate it and feel very privileged to have had the opportunity to join this this conversation with you.
Think Underground is a SIVA Creative Incorporated production, written and hosted by Arif Khan, produced by Brett Glover. Music courtesy 1M1 Music, directed by Arif Khan. Executive producers Mallory Steele and Arif Khan. Created by Mallory Steele.